Today is Friday, July 5th, 2019, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jim Bertel for Lori London. Coming up, the U.S. celebrates Independence Day, highlighted by a speech from President Trump.
On this day, 243 years ago, our founding fathers pledged their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor to declare independence and defend our God-given rights.
Also ahead, we'll celebrate one of the holiday's most famous traditions. It's all on today's International Edition. The Independence Day celebrations are winding down across the U.S. One of the biggest every year is here in Washington, with a parade, concert, and fireworks. But this year, it was celebrated a bit differently. President Trump spoke to the nation with a salute to America. Joining me is VOA's senior White House correspondent, Patsy Whitakaswara. Patsy, what was the president's message?
Well, the theme of his speech, as well as the celebration, is Salute to America. And in his speech, the president said that he is celebrating American history, American people, as well as the men and women of the United States military. Let's take a listen to some of what he said.
As we gather this evening, in the joy of freedom, we remember that all share a truly extraordinary heritage. Together, we are part of one of the greatest stories ever told, the story of America. It is the epic tale of a great nation whose people have risked everything for what they know is right and what they know is true.
Now, the speech today was not without some controversy.
Yeah, I mean, many people were concerned that the president was going to politicize the event by turning it into a political rally. But in his speech, he was quite restrained. He did not mention any of his, you know, favorite or regular campaign rally themes, and he did not attack his opponents. However, just by hosting the event in such a way with, you know, displays of American military might, including armored vehicle on the streets and fighter jet flyovers, the president was accused of politicizing and militarizing what is usually a nonpartisan holiday.
Well, there were partisan people on hand, very passionate on both sides, supporters of the president and protesters. You had a chance to speak to some of them. What were they telling you?
Well, the protesters are telling me that the president is politicizing a nonpartisan event, particularly by putting himself in the middle of the celebration, making it about him, and bringing up planes and tanks at the taxpayers' expense. But his supporters are saying that this is to celebrate the country and the military. Someone also told me that the celebration is for Trump supporters, the forgotten Americans. And one gentleman also told me that he supports this military display because that's what the enemies of the U.S. also do with their grand military parades. And he added that if I was an enemy of the United States, I would be scared right now.
VOA senior White House correspondent Patsy Whitakaswara, thank you for joining us. This is VOA's International Edition. Among the top stories in the world, police in the British territory of Gibraltar have seized an Iranian oil tanker suspected of carrying crude oil to Syria. 83 African migrants drowned when their boat sank off the Tunisian coast. A magnitude 6.4 earthquake rocked Southern California, resulting in several fires and minor injuries. An African Union envoy says Sudan's ruling military council and the country's pro-democracy movement have reached a power-sharing agreement. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute.
As a young child, you may have been ordered to eat your broccoli because it's good for you. Well, this sage advice is actually based in science. Past studies provided evidence that broccoli and other cruciferous vegetables like cabbage, cauliflower, and Brussels sprouts may play a role in inhibiting the growth of common forms of human cancer. A new study led by Dr. Pier Paolo Pandolfi at Boston's Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center suggests that a gene called WWP1 produces an enzyme that interferes with the work of a powerful cancer-suppressing gene called PTEN. Working with mice, Dr. Pandolfi and his team found evidence that I3C, a compound found in cruciferous vegetables, can shut down the production of this enzyme that keeps PTEN from doing its job in fighting cancer. The study was published in the journal Science. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
I'm Jim Bertel, sitting in for Lori London, and this is VOA's International Edition. Russian President Vladimir Putin was in Italy Thursday for the first time in 4 years. While there, he met with Italian leaders and traveled to the Vatican for talks with Pope Francis. Sabina Castelfranco has more for VOA from Rome.
Amid heavy security in Rome, President Vladimir Putin went straight from the airport to the Vatican to meet with Pope Francis, whom he had already met twice before. Putin was 1 hour behind schedule, but the Pope welcomed him with a warm handshake as soon as he arrived. The Russian leader thanked the Pope for the nearly 1 hour closed-door talks and called the discussion very substantive and interesting. The Vatican issued a statement after the meeting in the Apostolic Palace, saying the talks focused on the situations in Syria, Ukraine, and Venezuela. The conflict in Ukraine and last year's schism between the Russian and Ukrainian Orthodox churches had been expected to be the focus of discussions, but no further details were made available by the Vatican. Catholic leaders from Ukraine will be gathering at the Vatican in the coming days to discuss the various problems in the country. After the Vatican meeting, Putin met with Italian President Sergio Mattarella at the Quirinale Palace. Sources described bilateral relations between Russia and Italy as excellent, in spite of existing differences with the West on matters regarding Ukraine. Common concern was expressed by the Russian president and the Italian head of state about the civil war in Libya and the consequent return to Islamic terrorism in Syria. The importance of stability in Libya for Italy and Europe was also noted. Putin then held a meeting with Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte at government headquarters.
Abbiamo parlato in particolare della Libia.
Conte said they discussed the situation in Libya and shared the belief that the unstable situation could cause a further escalation on the ground, causing greater humanitarian problems, further insurgence of terrorism and insecurity for energy infrastructures. Both Conte and Putin agreed on the need to continue to support the United Nations in order to reach a ceasefire and the return to the negotiating table. The Russian president and Italian prime minister were also attending a meeting of the Russian-Italian Civil Society Dialogue Forum underway at the Foreign Affairs Ministry. Before departing, Putin had dinner with the Italian prime minister and the two deputy prime ministers Matteo Salvini and Luigi Di Maio, as well as Foreign Affairs Minister Enzo Moavero Milanesi. Putin also had a planned meeting with his longtime friend, former Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi, before returning to Moscow. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
The International Committee of the Red Cross is calling for the urgent revival of Yemen's stalled peace process. The conflict is deepening the country's already catastrophic humanitarian crisis. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The ICRC's director for the Near and Middle East region, Fabrizio Carboni, just returned from a mission to Yemen and does not mince his words. He says the country has collapsed and only a political solution will restore the hopes and future of millions of destitute people. Delegates from the warring parties, the Houthi and Yemeni government, attended UN-mediated talks in Stockholm, Sweden, on December 13, 2018. This was the first time the warring sides had met in 2 years. Carboni says the so-called Stockholm Agreement, which emerged from the talks, achieved some promising humanitarian accords, but is now blocked. One of the casualties of the breakdown, he says, was a prisoner swap agreed to by the parties to the conflict. He says the ICRC was ready to oversee the implementation of the prisoner exchange between the government and Houthi rebels earlier in the year. He says the operation, however, was aborted at the last minute.
Within the limits of our humanitarian work, we're really ready to go the extra mile. And that's what we did for the release of detainees. I mean, everything was ready. You know, we had the planes, we were in the collection point, everything, we're there. You know, you just have to push the button, start, and it happens.
Carboni says the ICRC is on standby, ready to go as soon as it is given the green light by the warring parties. In the meantime, he says, Red Cross delegates continue to visit detainees to check on their well-being. He tells VOA their conditions of detention are very difficult. He says their cells are stiflingly hot and humid with no air conditioning.
In places of detention who were built decades ago, if not century ago, we have, for instance, very often a problem of scabies. And you can imagine scabies in such an environment, it's a torture. It's hell. It's really hell.
The ICRC official says he believes all states and parties involved in this conflict want to find a way out of this tragedy. But this, he says, implies trade-offs. This means the parties have to negotiate and be willing to compromise on the issues. He understands the difficulties, but says he remains optimistic it can be done. The UN considers Yemen the worst humanitarian catastrophe in the world. It reports 17,700 civilians have been killed. This since the Saudi-led coalition began airstrikes against the Houthi rebels in March 2015 in support of the Yemeni government. The UN says more than 3.3 million people are displaced and 80% of the population, or 24 million people, need humanitarian assistance, with more than half of them being children. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is VOA's International Edition, and I'm Jim Bertel. President Donald Trump, facing renewed criticism from Democrats and activists over his handling of the migrant crisis on the U.S.-Mexico border, said on Twitter this week, the immigrants unhappy with conditions at detention centers should be told not to come. Democratic lawmakers and civil rights activists who have visited migrant detention centers along the border in recent days have described nightmarish conditions marked by overcrowding and inadequate access to food, water, and other basic needs. This week, UNICEF's executive director released a statement saying coordinated action is urgently needed to keep migrant children safe. International Edition's Lori London talked about it with UNICEF Communications Officer for Emergencies, Chris Tidy.
Everything that we've heard, or that's certainly been reported in the last few days and weeks with regard to the conditions that some migrant children are facing in some of the facilities along the southern border, those reports are deeply concerning to us. You know, any time you're hearing about, you know, children without access to the services and the support they need, you know, whether it be healthcare, education, protection, or just to be with their family, when you hear about that, that's very concerning. And the fact of the matter is that, you know, children are the most vulnerable. And when you're talking about a vulnerable group of people to begin with, which would be refugees and migrants, then the children among them are in an especially precarious position. And so these reports are very alarming to us.
I know that UNICEF came out about a year ago when it came to light that the U.S. was separating families and they were, you know, strongly against any such thing. Does it look to be, from your perspective, that it hasn't really improved since then as far as what we're seeing with all these children without any adults?
It seems as though that it's unclear at this stage. Certainly there are children at the southern border who are either arriving without their parents, so they're arriving unaccompanied, or for whatever reason there's some separation that's going on before or after they cross. That separation, as we've said before and said many times, when a child is separated from, especially a young child is separated from their parents, from their caregivers, that can be extremely traumatic for children. I think what a lot of people don't know is that, yes, it's traumatic and upsetting for children in the short term, but it can also undermine their long-term development because, there's a potential there for the buildup of toxic stress when children are faced with those sorts of situations. And that can really have longer term consequences for them as well. So regardless, it really needs to stop. Children have a right to be with their family, to be with their parents. And we would hope that any government anywhere in the world that is caring for refugee and migrant children would make sure that those kids are kept with their families.
The president on Wednesday said that these conditions that they're coming to are much better than what they're leaving, and that if they don't like it, they shouldn't come. Do these people really want to leave their countries?
No. I think I could say that pretty categorically. I've spent time in the region speaking with children and families from Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. Virtually everyone who I spoke with basically said that, they left or were choosing to leave because they felt they had no other option.
That was UNICEF Communications Officer for Emergencies, Chris Tidy, speaking with Lori London. And this is International Edition. The U.S. recently sponsored a workshop in Bahrain aimed to showcase the purported economic benefits a Mideast peace deal could bring. Spearheaded by White House advisor Jared Kushner, President Trump's son-in-law, it proposes an international fund to lift the West Bank, Gaza, and neighboring Arab state economies. But analysts say introducing economics, divorced from a realistic political plan, is a non-starter for Palestinians and Israelis. For VOA from Amman, Dale Gadlick reports.
U.S. commentator Nicole Nickpour praised the Trump administration for making a noble effort to help the Palestinian people with its new plan because she says they have not been treated adequately by their leadership. But Jordanian political analyst Labib Kamhawi believes the Bahrain workshop did not objectively tackle Palestinian concerns that could help resolve the long-standing crisis.
What we are looking at now is a systematic attempt under the title of Deal of the Century to close the Palestinian file and not to solve the Palestinian problem. And there is a big difference between closing the file and solving the problem. Everybody has to help the Palestinians to be steadfast and to keep their resolve in refusing this deal, whether it's in its political aspect or in its economic aspect.
Analysts also point out that the plan, dubbed Peace to Prosperity, made no reference to Israel's military occupation of the West Bank and its blockade of the Gaza Strip. A 2016 United Nations report found the Palestinian economy could double in size if the Israeli military occupation was lifted. As the Bahrain meeting unfolded, Israel's only two Arab peace partners, Jordan's King Abdullah and Egypt's President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, reaffirmed their support of Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas and for the two-state solution as the basis for any real peace deal. It is unclear whether the proposal will abandon the two-state solution, which is backed by the UN and most countries, and involves the creation of a Palestinian state alongside Israel. The Palestinian leadership refused to go to Bahrain and rejected the plan, saying its lack of political vision guarantees its failure. It also arrested a Palestinian businessman for attending the meeting, who was later released. Washington's recognition of disputed Jerusalem as Israel's capital in 2017 infuriated Palestinians and other Arabs. But Bahrain's foreign minister, Khaled bin Ahmed al-Khalifa, in his first interview with Israeli media, Channel 13 TV, says he thought the Palestinians had made a mistake by not showing up to what he called a game changer.
And it's always a mistake to miss an opportunity to achieve peace. for the Israeli public, they need to trust that there are countries in the region that do want peace and do encourage the Palestinians to go forward and do support them.
George Washington University professor Nathan J. Brown says he does not see the plan resolving the Palestinian conflict, but defining it out of existence. The most novel idea, he says, is that the Trump administration is asking Arab states to pay for its realization. Dale Gavlak for VOA News, Amman.
You're listening to International Edition from VOA.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
Voices, we're talking about the news and issues you're talking about,
sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick,
and Hadiza Kiari,
and Ayan Bior,
and Orion Itangi Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
Joining me is VOA national correspondent Jim Malone. Jim, until now, former Vice President Joe Biden held a substantial lead over the rest of the Democratic field. Then came the first Democratic debate last week. How have things changed?
Well, Jim, they have changed to some extent based on several polls we're getting since that debate. Now, we should point out we're very early in the presidential selection process. The first votes for the Democratic candidates won't actually occur until February 3rd in the Midwest state of Iowa next year. But what we've seen is some movement since that first debate. Biden slipping a bit, and two candidates in particular on the rise, Senator Kamala Harris of California and Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts, both taking their debate performances and turning them into gains in several polls. Harris in particular now has moved either into second or third place, depending on the poll you're looking at, and has significantly closed the gap she had with former Vice President Biden. Now, this can all be turned around, more debates to come, but based on the snapshot from that first debate, Harris and Warren are rising. Biden and Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders seem to be slipping a bit.
Well, what does that say about the liberal part of this field? Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, certainly two of the most liberal in their campaign platforms. Why do you think one's rising, the other's falling?
Yeah, that's a great question, and we're going to be looking at that for some time to come. It does seem as though Elizabeth Warren, who has a host of liberal policy prescriptions, very specific in detail, has a lot of passion on the campaign trail. It looks like her rise is coming a bit at the expense of Bernie Sanders. They do appear to be appealing to the same progressive wing of the Democratic Party that wants sort of government-run health care, that wants a much more liberal approach to, say, immigration and taking care of migrants as they come across the border. So there's that aspect of it. The other thing, though, in the polls we notice is Democrats seem most interested in finding a nominee next year who has the best chance of beating President Trump. And that has helped Joe Biden as long as he's been in the race, really, from the very beginning. He has been seen as the strongest contender on that. He still is seen that way, according to these latest polls. But if someone like Senator Harris or Senator Warren or others can make the case that they could be a strong contender, their stock would also rise, especially with more moderate Democrats who don't necessarily buy into some of the more liberal policy prescriptions that some of these candidates are offering.
Well, as you mentioned, this is early in the campaign, and the general election itself is still more than a year away. But you brought up Trump. How do the Democratic candidates stand up in the polls against President Trump?
Well, you know, we have had some polling in the last month or so that showed that particularly Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders were doing pretty well in head-to-head matchups against President Trump, in some cases beating him by double digits, not only nationwide, but in some of these key, what we call swing states or battleground states where the elections are often decided in our presidential races. And I think that sent off some alarm bells in the White House, because not only did some of the national polls reflect this, but some of the earlier internal polling by the Trump campaign showed some disturbing signs for the president in some key states, places like Florida, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, states he won in 2016, though some of them very narrowly. So I think certainly there's a concern that the president needs to be wary of some of these contenders. Some of the more liberal contenders in these earlier head-to-head polls barely beat Trump's, say, Senator Harris, Elizabeth Warren. So we don't know where all that will wind up eventually. But certainly Democrats were encouraged by these polls. And certainly I think Trump supporters were, you know, take it as a caution that the president needs to do some more work, though the president continues to focus mainly on bolstering his base of support.
It's worth noting that there are more than 20 Democratic candidates running for president. It's early. What's next for the Democrats?
Well, the debates are important because we've had the first one. You have to actually qualify for the debates, and the first two rounds, the debate in June and the debate upcoming later this month in Detroit, you need to average in certain qualifying polls at least 1% support in the polls to get on that debate stage. And you have to have a certain number of donors. In this case, I think it's 65,000 identifiable individual donors giving to your campaign. Now, once you get to the September debates, the third one, that's going to change. The qualifications will be raised so that if to get on that stage, you need to show at least 2% support in a number of polls, and you need to double the amount of donors. That's probably going to start to weed out some of the candidates we're seeing on the edges here. People in jeopardy there, like former Texas Congressman Beto O'Rourke, New Jersey Senator Cory Booker, Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar, and even former Housing Secretary Julian Castro. They're going to need to scramble to try to make that debate stage in September. If you start to fall off the debate stage, there's a good chance you're not going to make it very much further in the race.
VOA's national correspondent Jim Malone, always a pleasure to talk with you.
Same here. Thank you.
And you're listening to VOA's International Edition. Well, one of the 4th of July's annual traditions takes place on the boardwalk in Coney Island, New York. It's the annual Nathan's Famous July 4th hot dog eating contest, carried live on ESPN. Joey Chestnut captured his 12th title, downing 71 hot dogs in 10 minutes.
I was trying to break the record. My competitors were trying to beat me. I was in the heat. The heat got in my way a little bit. I think I got zapped a little bit. About 5 minutes in, I slowed down way more than I ever hoped I would. But it's all right. I got the win.
Chestnut inhaled one hot dog every 8.5 seconds on the way to defending the mustard yellow championship belt. Miki Sudo repeated as the women's champion, downing 31 hot dogs for her 6th straight win. Well, you've been listening to International Edition. My thanks to our studio team, director Tracy Carter and engineer Keith Holmes. I'm Jim Bertel for Lori London in Washington. Thanks for listening.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translation.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time,
with David Bandy.
This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. U.S. President